And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Today we examine the history of U.S. financial recessions, depressions, panics, and such. We have professor and author Scott Reynolds Nelson aboard. His latest book is A Nation of Deadbeats, An Uncommon History of America's Financial Disasters. And he joins us from public station WHRO in Williamsburg, Virginia. Welcome to you, Scott Reynolds Nelson.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you.
Thank you.
You say we may not be a deadbeat nation, but we're a nation of deadbeats. So what does that mean exactly?
Well, it's consumer credit is really at the heart of not just this financial panic, but every one of our financial panics in the past. And it's not so much that the federal government actually pays its debts, but individual consumers in large quantities have not. This has happened to us before, not just in 1929, but in 1792, in 1837, 1873. So we've been sort of not paying our debts for a very long time as individuals and as states. Florida's is one that didn't pay its debts in.
We don't have any deadbeats here.
Oh no! Oh, okay. Sorry, I must be confused. I must be wrong about Florida. I am a Floridian, actually. I was raised in Florida, raised in Sanford, and lived in Miami for a while.
Oh, I didn't know that. You mentioned you lived in Lauderhill.
Yeah. Well, I worked in Miami and lived in Lauderhill, so it was a very long commute.
So why has consumer debt influenced so many panics and depressions, and what's the difference between a panic and a depression and a recession?
Oh, gosh, the simple explanation
for a panic.
It's a cafeteria
question.
Cafeteria question. Okay. So a depression is that was actually the word that was preferred by Herbert Hoover. He liked the word depression. He thought it would be less scary than a recession. So he encouraged the use of the word. But a depression is a long-term drop in GDP. And so in one quarter, if gross domestic product drops a little bit, then you see a depression. A panic is when interest rates spike. And what we saw in 2008 is both a panic and a depression. So interest rates spiked. No one really knew why at the time. Then in 2007, and what happened was that a lot of banks were holding this debt that was problematic. And after that, we saw a depression. So in our experience, we saw a panic in 2007 and 2008, and then a depression in 2008 through last quarter.
Now, most people think that the 2008 recession was caused because of bad mortgages and also derivatives. Is that it? It is, yeah.
But that's actually not the first time that this has happened. A lot of pundits will tell you that this has never happened before. But no, it's part of what happens is you have lenders who want security. And they want 6%, but they also want security. And you can't have both of those things. The collateralized debt obligation was a way of taking a risky mortgage, packaging it with a bunch of other risky mortgages, seemingly eliminating the risk, and then selling it to a bank and saying, look, you'll get 6%, don't worry. But that's not the first time Americans have done this, have tried to sell off risky debt as not risky debt. And the same thing happened with the railroads in the 1850s, with cotton plantations in the 1830s, with farms out in the Midwest in the 18-teens. So in each of those cases, individuals have borrowed lots of money. It's all been packaged together and sold in this instrument that looks secure but is actually deeply, deeply flawed.
Well, why don't we go back to the 1700s?
Okay.
And since you're a history professor, the Constitution, you say, addressed banking and financial interests?
Yes. So initially what happens is the U.S. Is fighting a war. It tries to issue this currency called Continental Dollars. But at the time, the Continental Congress has no way of taxing. And as a result, no one trusts that these Continental Dollars that they're issuing are going to be worth anything. And there's runaway inflation with these things. You could buy a Continental Dollar for a penny, 2 cents, 3 cents during the Revolution. It's at this point that there's a real push to fix this problem, and lots of Americans are upset about it. And the people who come up with a solution are Alexander Hamilton and his assistant William Dewar. And they say, look, we need a constitution. We need a way to get Congress to have a taxing power. And we need to take up all this debt that we've accumulated in fighting this war, turn it into regular debt, sell it abroad, and everything will be fine. Enough states kind of sign on to the constitution. Hamilton and Madison and others, you know, push for the Constitution. And then about 3 weeks later, Hamilton proposes the creation of the first bank of the United States, and it buys up all of this debt. It instantly makes Hamilton's assistant, William Dewar, a millionaire, the nation's first millionaire, because he, it turns out, is holding the vast majority of this debt. He's bought it up at nickels on the dollar, and he sells it. So, yeah, there were some pretty shaky deals in this period. The other thing that happens is that there's preferential access to the Bank of the United States. It's basically the first version of the Federal Reserve. And people who own it, who own stock in the bank, First Bank of the United States, are half of the members of Congress have gotten preferential access. Luckily, that kind of corruption doesn't happen in Washington anymore. But there was a time when it did. when it did. Yeah.
Now, Jefferson and Madison, the Virginians versus yes. Hamilton, what was the big contention there?
Well, so Madison and Hamilton are on the same side initially. They think that there ought to be a constitution. They think that the federal government shouldn't issue currency. They leave it kind of up in the air. And then Hamilton comes along with this Bank of the United States idea, and Madison sees, oh, this was all a ruse. This was all a plan to build up this financial infrastructure. And so the first party system that we get is based not on states' rights, not on conflicts over the Constitution, but really fundamentally about the bank. It's when Jefferson reads that half of the members of Congress have been bought by the Bank of the United States that he creates this new party that's called the Democratic Republicans. We call them Democrats now. They're basically the heir to the Democratic Party. And their aim is really to destroy this Bank of the United States, a bank that they see as corrupting the legislature. On the flip side of this, it's true that lots of members of Congress were bought by the First Bank of the United States. The First Bank of the United States, though, was an amazingly efficient instrument. It did issue all of the debt. It paid off all the debt. The U.S. finished off, paying its debt by 1811, and everyone was paid off. Every creditor in Europe was paid off. And this is partly why America gets a kind of free pass from 1811 forward, is that Americans are the first and only country that's ever paid off all of its debt at one go. And this gives us basically carte blanche for the next 200 years to screw things up, and we do.
But the charter wasn't renewed for
the First Bank of the United States. Yeah, so Jefferson tries to destroy the First Bank of the United States. He's unsuccessful at doing it when he's elected in 1800, but he does keep it from getting rechartered. And this recharter... The fact that it's not rechartered means that the First Bank of the United States has to close up accounts. It has to pay off all of its creditors. It does pay off all of its creditors. But what Hamilton said, and this is Hamilton was smart here. He said, as long as our debts are being held in Britain, Britain's not going to fight a war with us, because British merchants want to get their money back. If they ever get their money back, we're in trouble. So this is precisely what Jefferson does. He gives them all their money back. He closes down the First Bank of the United States. And as soon as the last check is paid on the First Bank of the United States, Britain says, all this smuggling that Americans have been doing in our war with Napoleon, it's got to stop. And if it doesn't stop, we're going to go to war with you. And so this is where the War of 1812 comes, is basically a year after the First Bank of the United States closes up shop. We see the War of 1812, and it's a bloody mess. The problem for the U.S. is there's no way now to issue debt, because they've closed down the First Bank of the United States. So kind of gnashing their teeth, the Democrats create their own bank. And it's called the Second Bank of the United States.
So that's how they funded the war?
What they do is they get three or four very wealthy investors on the East Coast to buy up federal debt. And once the war is over, then they say, look, you need a second bank. You need to sell these bonds. We're holding all these bonds. I know we bought them for 20 cents on the dollar, but we can't sell them anywhere. We need a second Bank of the United States. And they lobby and ultimately get a second Bank of the United States.
Now, we look at our wallet, and there's a $20 bill. And, of course, Andrew Jackson is aboard that. And, of course, he has a long history in Florida. But why did the Bank of the United States become such a fixation for Andrew Jackson to, destroy it?
Jackson was really replaying Jefferson's war. You know, he sees the Second Bank of the United States created. He had his own financial problems in the 1790s, signing off debt that he couldn't pay. He becomes very, very, very conservative about lending money. And he sees the Second Bank of the United States as an institution that's just as potentially corrupt as the First Bank of the United States. And so he decides that he's effectively going to replay Jefferson's war against the bank as his war. That's part of the story. Part of the story is, too, that there's a fellow, James Watson Webb, who's a newspaper man who builds Jackson's party. James Watson Webb is bought effectively by the Bank of the United States in 1831 or 32. And it's at that point that James Watson Webb switches sides. He supports Jackson all the way through until 1832, when he gets a special loan from the Second Bank of the United States, and then he switches sides. It's James Watson Webb that creates the Whig Party, the party that's basically the opponent to the Democratic Party. It's the Second Bank of the United States that funds, effectively, the origins of the Whig Party. So Jackson was right to be suspicious of the Second Bank, and those mutual suspicions lead to a serious financial clash. Britain starts to get wind of this conflict, and they start to pull back on their loans, and that's when we get the Panic of 1837. It's really the end of that Jackson's war against the bank. So we get our second panic right at the end of that.
We're speaking with Scott Reynolds Nelson. He's a professor of history at the College of William and Mary and an award-winning author and journalist. His latest book is A Nation of Deadbeats, An Uncommon History of America's Financial Disasters. We're going to take a short break on Topical Currents, and we'll be back.
And we're back. It's today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, on this Wednesday edition.
Tuesday.
Edition. Well, okay, whatever. Tell me, I know we're kind of jumping around. Scott Reynolds Nelson, he's the author of A Nation of Deadbeats, An Uncommon History of America's Financial Disasters. But tell us of the importance of Nicholas Biddle, B-I-D-D-L-E, and was he an ancestor of Sidney Biddle Barrows, more commonly known as the Mayflower Madam?
Gosh, probably. I don't know. I hadn't thought that.
Maybe I think that connection.
Is he? Okay. So Nicholas Biddle is an old line Federalist. The Federalist Party is gone, really, with the War of 1812. It turns out, FYI, you never want to be the party that backs the government that you're fighting in a war. And so the Federalists are basically the pro-British party. Once the U.S. is truly in the War of 1812, it's not really safe to be a Federalist. He's an old-line Federalist. He's suspicious of Andrew Jackson. And Biddle basically builds a kind of financial empire. He figures out that the way to fire up lending again in the South, particularly in the American South, is to accept debt from cotton banks, which are then effectively lending to planters who are buying slaves in the expanding regions. This is in the 1820s and early 1830s, expanding regions, Mississippi, Alabama, a little bit in North Florida. And those banks are then effectively creating notes, which are then being sold in Britain. And then in Britain, they're being sold to banks in the north of England. And so what you have is anti-slavery folks in the north of England who are putting their money in banks who don't realize it, but they effectively have collateralized debt obligations for plantations in the American South. And when the Panic of 1837 happens, when Biddle and Jackson sort of come to blows over this controversy, what Jackson does is pass the specie circular, which says, all right, if you're going to buy land, you can't use these notes from the Bank of the United States anymore. You have to use cash. This crushes the market for the Bank of the United States notes, and we see this phenomenal depression. And then what happens is lots of bankers in the north of England realize that the ultimate collateral for what they have is slaves in Mississippi and Alabama. This, they're quite shocked by this. Very much in the way, same way that Taiwanese banks and in 2008 and 2009 discovered that all these bonds that they're holding are effectively mortgages in Las Vegas, Florida, and Texas. A lot of Taiwanese banks, a lot of Finnish banks, a lot of sovereign wealth funds, they're holding these bonds, but they don't really understand that deep down what they're holding is bad debt in Florida, Texas, and California. Likewise, the same thing happens with Biddle. Biddle has figured out a way of taking debt in these plantation regions and turning it into bonds that people in the north of England will buy. In both cases, you see a collapse of Biddle's fortunes, really, in 1837.
Now, is he the one that loaned the money or gave the money to James Watson Webb?
It is. So what happens is that Andrew Jackson in his second inaugural address says, you know, I'm a little concerned about this Bank of the United States. I think it's a good idea, but I think maybe the Treasury Department should do it. It should all be under the Treasury, and we should close down the second Bank of the United States. Biddle hears about this, and he's terrified. He contacts a third party, and the third party lends money to a bunch of influential newspapers, including the New York Courier, which is the biggest circulation newspaper in America at the time. And that's James Watson Webb's paper. Okay. And basically gets the Courier and Inquirer to change its position and to say, we support the Second Bank of the United States. It should be rechartered. Jackson is wrong. And this is a pretty obvious, flagrant case of corruption. The thing is that James Watson Webb is a very good shot. And so when the first editor accuses him of corruption, James Watson Webb shoots him. he calls for a duel. He shoots him. He kills him. And then no more editors in New York are willing to call James Watson Webb corruptionist anymore for some reason. There's a special investigation in Congress, and they determine that, in fact, James Watson Webb was paid by the Second Bank of the United States. So it's in the official documents, but no newspaper is willing to touch this because James Watson Webb is very good with a pistol.
Now, was he a politician because he started this party, the Whig Party?
He's sort of a politician. This is at a time in the 1820s and 1830s where newspapers are hugely influential in terms of parties. We're used to thinking about newspapers as being more or less nonpartisan. But in the 1820s and 30s, they were party papers. So if you got a Whig paper, let's say there's an accident in New York City and you've got a Whig paper, and it's a Whig carriage that runs over some Democrat. The Whig paper will say, you know, some drunken Democrat, you know, fell under the wheels of a Whig carriage and there was an accident. And the Democratic paper will say some, you know, Tony Whig crazy person driving along the road hit a poor, upstanding Democrat and killed him. So every piece of news was very political in the 1820s and 1830s. And so James Watson Webb was a party man. And newspapers were hugely influential in kind of building parties. And so James Watson Webb comes up with the term Whig. He says, look, you know, this Jackson guy is acting like a king. And in Britain, the people who oppose the power of the king were called the Whigs. So this is the name that we need for our party. And then James Watson Webb, his influence, he then helps to fund a bunch of competing newspapers. And that's really the beginning of the Whig Party.
We're speaking with, Scott Reynolds Nelson, and we're talking about his book, A Nation of Deadbeats, An Uncommon History of America's Financial Disasters. If you'd like to join in the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. You can email radio at WLRN.org, or you can tweet us at Topical Currents.
Tell me, Scott Reynolds Nelson, how did consumer debt influence the American Civil War?
Well, we're used to thinking of railroads as, you know, the choo-choo, right? The train, the tracks, and that sort of thing. But a railroad in the 1850s was really a kind of bank. It was the way it worked is that a railroad, say, planned from central Illinois to southern Illinois, would get grants of land from Congress. It would then start to build track, and then it would take this land and carve it up into little, 100-acre tracts, and sell those on mortgages to people in Europe. The railroads would pay for their passage from Europe to the U.S. They pay for their arrival on their land. And then over a period of 5 years, usually, the person who came to settle on this land would pay back every time he had a harvest. He would pay back, or they, the family would pay back this mortgage. This railroad then would take all of these loans to settlers. And they, you know, railroads in the 1850s were everywhere in Europe. They were anybody who had a nickel in their pocket, they were trying to convince them to come to America and settle. And they would take all this debt, all this mortgage debt, and package it up into bonds and sell it in Europe. So effectively, the lending and mortgage was happening in Europe, and the settlers were coming from Europe. All of this through the power of these railroads. So the railroad is effectively acting as a bank. This seems like a very kind of clever way of getting people to settle in the Midwest. It turns out that Europeans don't want to settle in the South. And so when lots of Southern railroads get started, they can't persuade people in the north of England to go to Mississippi or Alabama and settle. And so what happens is that the American upper Midwest, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, fill up very quickly. Kansas, all these other, Missouri, but the southern states don't fill up nearly as quickly. And so this group of planters called the F Street Mess decide they're going to put a stop to this. And so they try to, they initially created their own railroad across through Missouri. The Missouri Railroad is a huge, it's got 100 million acres of beautiful land in Missouri. And it's just too fat a target for Boston capitalists, including, oh, what is his name? Sorry, there's a group called the Boston Associates. I've now forgotten the name of the principal in it. And they effectively take a hostile takeover of this Missouri. Missouri is a slave state. They take over the land. They start to issue these mortgages in the West. And what planters in the South do, in Missouri do, is they come up with an alternative plan to nix this. And what they do is they persuade a bunch of people to Missourians who are upset about having lost their land to cross the border into Kansas and vote in the Kansas elections. And this is really the beginning of the War over Kansas in 1855 and 56, a war that's really the beginnings of the American Civil War, as basically northern kind of landowners or would-be landowners and southern would-be landowners are fighting over this land in Kansas that's just west of Missouri, just west of this fantastic Missouri Railroad. This conflict is one that effectively the Southerners lose. The Southerners try to beat them out, but lots and lots and lots of New Englanders bring their Bibles and their rifles, and they come to Kansas, and they just dwarf the Southerners.
And this is where John Brown got his start.
This is where John Brown got his start. He brought his rifle and his Bible into Kansas, and he and his sons, you know, hacked apart some Southern settlers with hatchets at some point. Mm-hmm. And so this this is where the Kansas conflict starts, and the Kansas conflict is one that the Southerners lose. And so the Southerners have a parting shot. And that is this is a little bit complicated, but it's a story of the Swamp Act of 1850. And the Swamp Act of 1850 says basically, or 51, basically says that any land that Congress owns all the land in the West, says any land that in the West that's swampland, a state can take it over, turn it from swampland into regular grassland, you know, drain it, and then sell it, and it's theirs. The trouble with the Swamp Act of 1851 is the people who decide whether land is swamp land or not is are basically the state themselves. And so, as you can imagine, Florida gets in on this hard and fast in the 1850s, declaring everything, declaring Miami to be swamp, declaring Tallahassee and every place that's not a swamp to be a swamp. Arkansas declares that the top of the Ozark Mountains are swampland. And so what you have then are two competing folks looking for land in the West. The railroads, who have got all this land mortgaged and selling bonds in Europe, and these states who have their own interests in claiming this land. And so the surveyors, the Federal Land Office, has a serious trouble figuring out who owns this land. you know, the state says it's swampland, but the railroad says it's their land because it passes along the level of the railroad. And so there's all this controversy over who owns the land. So the parting shot by the Southerners is the Revised Swamp Act of 1857. And what it says is all that land in the West, all that land that the state say is swampland, it's swampland. And what it does is destroy the market for those all that railroad land in the West, because it potentially calls into question all of this land that's mortgaged in the West. All these mortgages now come into question, because if the state owns all this land, then the railroads don't own it at all. And that's the panic of 1857, a financial panic in which people start dumping in Europe all these bonds for the Illinois Central, the Western Central, all these Michigan Central, every other railroad. And then you see interest rates rise, and then you see financial panic begin, and then you see banks fail. And there's one person who's a candidate in 1859.
And I'm going to ask you not to say that candidate's name, because
okay,
we're going to take a break. And
okay,
we'll let
okay,
everybody
sorry,
on the edge of their seat. We're speaking all with right, Scott Reynolds Nelson, professor of history at the College of William and Mary. And his latest book is A Nation of Deadbeats, An Uncommon History of America's Financial Disasters. Let's take that break, and we'll be right back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Professor Scott Reynolds Nelson of the College of William and Mary. He's joining us from Williamsburg, Virginia. And his book is A Nation of Deadbeats, An Uncommon History of America's Financial Disasters. If you'd like to join in, you're certainly welcome. That number is 1-800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. Also, email radio@WLRN.org.
Or you can tweet us at Topical Currents. We do have a tweet.
Now, we were talking about a deadbeat
attorney. A deadbeat attorney. That was it.
So the story is, in the panic of 1857, all of these railroad bonds are up for question. Lots and lots of the railroads fail. There's one candidate for the Republican Party in the 1858-59 who's a dark horse candidate for the presidency, whose specialty is railroad claims against the Swamp Act. Because all this litigation between the railroads and these states over who owns this land leads to lots of huge legal fees, as you can imagine, lots and lots of fighting. And one guy who's a specialist in the conflicts between the railroads and the states over this land. The Swamp Act of 1857 has effectively invalidated, or potentially invalidated, all of this Western land that the railroads own. One person is that dark horse person is, of course, Abraham Lincoln, a Western candidate who is there seems to be absolutely no kind of support for Lincoln early on, but then the Boston Associates and all the other railroad folks say this is the guy who's going to save our butts. That he's the one who's going to, once he comes to office, he's going to say all these state claims against the railroads for this land is wrong. That's their hope, and they pin it on him. In the end, Abraham Lincoln doesn't do what they hope, and he supports the railroads, but he doesn't issue an executive order that invalidates the state's claims on these on this Western land. But what happens is that you get this peculiar coalition of these very wealthy Boston capitalists and New York capitalists who are involved with these railroads, and these anti-slavery folks in Kansas. And when they get those folks together, the money and the kind of vision about slavery and the end of slavery together, that builds the Republican Party, and it becomes a behemoth. It becomes incredibly important. It's bankrolled effectively by lots and lots of these railroad folks, and it's got lots of anti-slavery folks who are going to, you know, knock on the doors and make sure that this party gets built. And once Lincoln becomes a presidential candidate, lots of white Southerners who are planters start to see the writing on the wall. They say this guy is going to end slavery, and this is how we get a civil war. It's basically then that South Carolina says, if Lincoln is inaugurated as president, we're going to secede, and then we get Fort Sumter, the conflict over Fort Sumter, as Southerners start to grab all of these federal installations that have gold and rifles and things like that.
What happened to the land? Were the railroads able to keep it?
Ultimately,
or did the state?
Did.
Oh, okay.
ultimately, in most cases, the railroads did win. It was just more protracted. Some of these legal fights between the railroads and the states lasted until the 1870s and 1880s, if you can imagine. But in the end, in almost all cases, the problem is, you know, how can you say in general whether this land is swampland or not? And ultimately what happens is you basically, the railroads took the states to court again and again and again, and finally in most cases got back the land that they had been promised by Congress in 1851 and 52.
1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. First caller, we've got Alberto in Doral. Hi there.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi.
I have a question for Scott, and this is a great subject. I don't know the exact quotation, but I remember reading the book that back in 1802, one of these gentlemen, very prominent figure, either was Jackson or Jefferson, said at the time that he fears more banking institutions than an entire army. And I would like to know, how does it feel, Mr. Cotton, you feel about that being taking place today? And on a related question, how do you reconcile the fact that banks have paid billions of dollars in settlement the last few years, and yet nobody seems to really follow through? There's no one behind bars, and it just I don't get it. I don't get this part of billions of dollars being paid off and everything is, you know, status quo. Thank you so much.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. It's an interesting idea, there's fear of banking more than armies, because in a certain sense, 1802 sounds like the right time. It's right around 1791, really the beginnings of the French Revolution, that most European states start to realize that they can't pursue a war if they don't have a bank. That a bank is something, because a war after around 1792 requires debt. And so you have to be able to take a lot of if a state, if Germany wants to expand, if it wants to invade Austria, if it wants France wants is fighting some conflict with Italy, if Austria-Hungary wants to expand, all of them have to come to bankers to get the advance that's going to pay for soldiers and food and all these other sorts of things. So they're intimate related, banking and and armies. And in fact, most of the long-term lending that takes place from 1800 until really the 19-teens, is much of the long-term lending is really for wars. That's how Europeans lend money, is for wars, and it's to states. So But I think the quote, it could have been either Jefferson or Jackson in 1802. What they're talking about is the potential for a bank to corrupt Congress. And to be fair, you know, both of the First Bank and the Second Bank of the United States did good things for the U.S., but they intimately involved themselves in politics, and they created parties, and they were powerfully important and yet corrupt institutions. The billions in settlements. I spoke to a guy who is the but no prosecutions. I guess the Touré prosecution is coming. The Goldman Sachs. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing his name right. The trouble is that this is what's largely happened here is there's so many interrelated people who are involved in creating these complex financial instruments, and many of them no longer work in the places where they are. Sarbanes-Oxley was supposed to be able to prosecute them. The federal prosecutors have been trying to go after these people, but many of them, it's very much like in the Cohen case, you can't get people to testify against one another, even with threats of jail time. And so that's one of the problems. It's a serious problem. I think the thing, though, is that in the longest term, what you have here is we've in the last, I don't know, 30 or 40 years, we've taken the sort of ethical questions away from banking and assumed that banking is mostly a technical issue, and mostly that if you have a downturn, you just inject cash into the economy, you know, inject liquidity, and then you solve your problems. And the sort of ethical and moral dimensions of banking is something that we need to kind of, as a nation, seriously think about. And I'm not invoking Jackson again. I don't want us to go back to the days of believing that everyone you know, who's connected with a bank is evil and ought to be shot. But just seriously thinking about the potential problems and the potential influence of financial institutions in Congress, in the various states, is a serious problem and one we need to think about.
Well, we're into the 1870s. I don't know how we're going to get to 2012, or 13 rather. But yeah. So there's another rapid increase in the interest rates. What happened then?
Yeah. So that this is sort of how I. That's a little bit of background here about me. I sort of my specialty is this 1870s. I had written before about this, and I guess it was in October of 2008. I had September 2007. I was concerned about the increase. The European Central Bank injected $10 billion into the other banks to get them to lend to each other. That was the summer of 2007. And I got worried about that. I thought, why is the bank injecting $10 billion into the other banks to get them to lend? Why aren't the banks lending to each other? That's scary. That's disturbing. And so I called my wife and I said, you know, this is a lot like the panic of 1873, where the banks don't trust each other and they're raising the rates and no one knows why. So I said, you know, we need to take our retirement. We don't have a huge amount of retirement. We're college professors. But we need to take our retirement out of the stock market and put in the bond market because something's wrong. Something's really wrong. So fast forward another year, and then I'm watching all this stuff unfold, and I see that this is a whole lot like the Panic of 1873. Not just a little like the Panic of 1873, it's a whole lot like the Panic of 1873, which basically was a series of bank failures that started, then stock markets followed, and then basically a serious crash. And so I started to see these sort of similarities. Here's the similarities. Three empires in Europe are building are sort of expanding: France, Austria-Hungary, and Prussia. And these three empires had this kind of dream that their capital cities will become hubs. And so we have Paris, Vienna, and Berlin, and all three of them get all of this these new banks that are created for them in the 1860s. And these banks issue mortgages. And these mortgages allow a flourishing of the capital cities. We see Austria take down its walls around Austria. France creates all these boulevards. And this mortgage kind of boom commences. But the trouble is that there's a new competitor on the horizon, one that nobody has really thought of in the past, and that is from the West. It's not China with it's America. Because America has, during the American Civil War in the 1860s, created these corridors for shipping wheat from the Midwest all the way to New York and to Liverpool. By 1872, Europe goes from importing its wheat. Britain goes from importing most of its wheat from Russia to importing most of its wheat from the U.S. And what this does is it has a chain of effects throughout Europe, because Europe had been providing food to, particularly wheat, to Britain for about 40 years. And suddenly, it's going to the cheap stuff. Britain is going to the cheap stuff in 1872, and this cheap stuff is coming from the U.S. And they radically changed the way that wheat is manufactured and ground and turned into bread and flour and bread. And what this does is lead to a cataclysmic mortgage crash in Vienna.
Scott Reynolds, Nelson, we're running late.
We need to
take a
short
break. Okay. We'll come back with another segment after this.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. We're speaking with Scott Reynolds Nelson, professor of history at the College of William and Mary. And his latest book is A Nation of Deadbeats, An Uncommon History of America's Financial Disasters. So we're here at 1873, and it's a lot like 2008.
And we haven't gotten to 1929 yet.
No.
Can you tell that I haven't been teaching in 2 months? Let me tell you about this. Let me tell you. So 1873 is basically Britain raises the interbank lending rate. At this point, there's no LIBOR. There's no London Interbank Offered Rate. Basically, the Bank of England sets the rate, and the Bank of England is scared about these banks, and so it raises the interest rate very quickly. And this not surprisingly, it leads to colossal bank failures throughout Europe, because if the interbank lending rate goes up, the banks need to borrow money quickly, or they need to call in their loans to their customers And when they do that, many of them fail because the customers don't have the cash. But this leads to a cascade of banking failures that ultimately hits New York in it hits Vienna in May of 1873, but it hits New York in October of 1873. And we see basically a seven-year-long crash and that's seven-year-long depression. And that's – so what I said was that 1873 looks a lot like this. I said that in 2008, and I said, you know, people are saying this is going to be 6 months or a year, and I think it's going to be – going to be 5 to 7 years, just like it was in then, because the financial infrastructure was broken. Basically, the banks were broken, and interbank lending trust had collapsed. And that's the center of the world. I mean, we think of the stock market as the center of the world or the London. No, it's banks. And banks lending to other banks. And when trust between banks collapses, then grass grows up on Main Street. That's what we see.
Are these interest rate hikes then? Is that what we should look for? They're without reason at the heart of most of these panics?
Exactly. And that's precisely what happened in 73. People couldn't really understand at first why the interest rate was going up. People had made all these assumptions about what their banks were going to lend to them. And then suddenly when interest rates go up, they called it the TED spread back in 2007. They said, huh, it's funny, you know, for 25 years, every time the Treasury rate changes a little bit, the interbank lending rate changes a little bit. But the interbank lending rate's going up, but the Treasury rate staying the same. So that's what happened in 2007 and 2008. And that was really the first kind of warning signs of this downturn. I could talk about 1893, but maybe 29 is the thing that you're more interested in. That's the crisis that's
well, everybody thinks it was because of stock speculation that caused that. Is that?
Yeah, not really. It is in a certain sense. What happens is that basically the Federal Reserve kind of goes online in around right before World War I, 1912, and the 1914, the Federal Reserve goes online and it starts lending, and this lending is fuels a massive industrialization, and if Ford and all sorts of other industries take advantage of the fact that there's cheap lending coming from the U.S. Largely through the auspices of the Federal Reserve that's created, and the kind of well is dried up. There are no more borrowers really by 1924, and so the big start to go to Europe. And so this is really this is the flip side of every other crash that I've talked about. Every other crash has been Europe lending to America. 1920s is America lending to Europe. Wake of World War I, hyperinflation in Austria-Hungary and Germany. And so the U.S. starts to lend in large quantities to individual consumers again in Germany. This is not the big loans for the Germany. This is for loans for states and for swimming pools and all sorts of other institutions, lots of gymnasiums and stuff like that in Germany. And then around 1928, there's an interview with Hitler, who is not yet chancellor, but he's seen as being a pretty strong candidate for chancellor in the future. And he says, you know, all these loans that Americans are making to Europe, we're not going to pay them all back. And this leads to a seizure in the bond markets. And all of these Midwestern banks, mostly German folks, have bought these bonds in Germany, and no one is willing to buy these bonds anymore. And so Goldman Sachs comes up with an interesting idea. They say Goldman Sachs is just this brand, relatively new institution. It says, you know, what we need to do is lend money to people in the stock market, because lots of people want to borrow money in the stock market. The states in Europe are in trouble, but if we lend money to people in the stock market, we'll just automatically cut them off if their bets go sour. And so we see Goldman Sachs create all of these bonds for banks that are effectively funding investment in the stock market, leveraged investment in the stock market. And then, of course, the crash of 29 brings an end to it. So I would say the longer term crash that's on the way in 29 is really has to do with Americans lending to Europe and those bonds, those debts never being paid back. In fact, Germany doesn't like to hear this. Angela Merkel will be very upset to hear this. But those bonds were never paid back. Those loans that a lot of central Americans made to states, small states in Germany, were never paid back. This is not the debts that Germany owes. And so I said the biggest deadbeat nation in the 20th century is Germany. It's very funny that Germany is now kind of complaining about Greece and Italy and Rome, you know, Greece and Italy and these other places not paying their debts. Germany was the serious offender, the one that they were the big deadbeats in the 1920s. Mm. And in a certain sense, they brought on the Depression of 29.
Well, there was such resentment against the Treaty of Versailles terms.
Right, right. And that was the sort of excuse, I guess, was the Treaty of Versailles, which had huge reparations that the German federal government had to pay back to France and to the Allies. And then France was paying money back to the U.S. for its munitions. That part of it is well understood. The less well understood part of it is all these Midwestern German banks that are lending in what's called the bond boom of 1925 to 28, lending to Baden-Baden and Heisenberg and all these other Bamberg and Berlin, all these other principalities and cities and states and things like that that never get paid.
Well, we didn't really cover as much as we would have liked.
It's been a very interesting hour.
Very interesting with Scott Reynolds Nelson. He's a professor of history at the College of William and Mary, an award-winning author and journalist. And his latest book is A Nation of Deadbeats, An Uncommon History of America's Financial Disasters. We'll have a link to your book on our website, WLRN.org, and on our Facebook page. And you're at Nelson Hist.
SRNELS at WM.EDU is the best way to reach me.
Okay. Thanks so much for joining us today.
And thank you for listening this hour. Our producer is Richard Ives, technical direction from Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Of course, we have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. Click on radio to proceed. We also have more information, discussion, and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program is one of our patented At Your Service editions. We'll have an informed panel to discuss changes in landlord-tenant law and take your questions. Who's responsible for eradicating bed bugs in a rental apartment? And the calendar. On this day in 1863, 150 years ago, the birth of auto pioneer Henry Ford in Dearborn, Michigan. He learned mechanics working on steam engines. And on this day in 1890, 123 years ago, the birth of baseball's one and only Casey Stengel in Kansas City. The greatest Yankee manager, he played 14 years in the National League. He also studied dentistry. Yow, Casey performing a root canal. One more before we assess collateral damage. On this day in 1947, 66 years ago, the birth of the former governator, strongman Arnold Schwarzenegger in Graz, Austria. He'll reprise his role as the barbarian in the 2014 film The Legend of Conan. At his fitness peak, he could deadlift 680 pounds. Yet, of course, we leave with a thought from the old professor, Casey Stengel, who hit the first home run in Yankee Stadium history. Quote, "The trouble is not that players have sex the night before a game. It's that they stay out all night looking for it." Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Next, it's Here and Now from NPR News.